The two northern papers give prominence to the leadership contest in the Democratic Unionist Party taking place today and look forward to the result, which the Irish News says is expected after 4 o'clock. That paper says that Geoffrey Donaldson MP is odds-on favourite. He has said that if he wins, he hopes to become First Minister. This means he would run in the next Assembly election, triggering a Westminster by-election. The Belfast Telegraph says that Mr. Donaldson and his rival, Edwin Poots, are engaged in a flurry of last-minute telephone conversations and meetings with MLAs in the final 24 hours of the race. A baptism of fire awaits the new DUP leader, says the paper. Not quite a baptism of fire for Boris Johnson, but the Irish Times reports that the summit meeting between him and the Taoiseach in Chequers, the Prime Minister's country residence today, is expected to be dominated by discussions on the legacy of the Troubles and on the Northern Ireland Protocol. The main story for the Irish Independent is that the government's own research warned in 2019 that cuckoo funds were unlikely to help boost the supply of affordable housing, but could instead develop monopolistic power in parts of the market they came to dominate. Meanwhile, the paper says it has emerged that Fianna Fáil councillors in Cavan voted to rezone residential land to green spaces despite objections from senior local authority officials. In other property news, the Irish Daily Mail describes as a bonanza for home buyers the 20-year fixed-rate mortgage launched by Finance Ireland. Best of all, says the paper, the non-bank lender is backed by taxpayer cash, as the state-owned Strategic Investment Fund has a 30% stake in Finance Ireland. RTE's Lucky Stars is the headline in the Irish Daily Star over a report that Gardaí have said that staff at RTE will not face charges over a retirement gathering at the station last November during the Level 5 restrictions. The Irish Examiner leads with a claim by the ISPCC that social media platforms are allowing the continued cyberbullying of children by refusing to take meaningful action when complaints are made. The Irish Sun reports in its lead story that a 13-year-old boy has been questioned about what the paper calls a horror attack at Howth Junction Dart Station in Dublin. The paper says that he and two 16-year-old youths, one of them a promising footballer, were arrested yesterday morning over an incident at the station last month in which a girl fell from a platform. All three were later released without charge. The matter gets much coverage elsewhere. The Irish Independent reports that Gardaí carried out searches of 5 properties in North Dublin yesterday on foot of warrants, and that Gardaí are continuing their investigation of the incident.
Just as we came on air, the Rotunda Maternity Hospital issued a statement saying they're experiencing a major ransomware cyber attack, which is affecting all of the hospital's electronic systems and records. Staff at the hospital are working to resolve the issue. All appointments have been cancelled for today, Friday the 14th of May. The only exception is for patients who are 36 weeks or more pregnant, and otherwise clients are asked not to attend the Rotunda unless it's an emergency. The master of the Rotunda Hospital, Fergal Malone, is on the line. Fergal Malone, good morning, and tell us how this evolved.
Good morning, Anya. We discovered during the night that we were the victim of what's called a Conti ransomware attack. This has, we also believe, affected other hospitals. And it basically means that we've had to shut down all of our computer systems. Now, thankfully, we have contingency plans in place for this, that the hospital can function absolutely normally using a paper-based system. But obviously, throughput will be much slower. So all patients in the hospital are safe. All the care is being provided. There's no problems for patient safety. But as a precaution, we're asking all patients who have appointments at the Rotunda today to not attend the hospital unless it's an emergency or unless they're 36 weeks pregnant or over.
The machinery and equipment, the life-saving machinery and equipment that you would have in the delivery suites and the premature baby units, are they all okay?
Yes, all equipment such as that are all absolutely operational and fine. It's computers logging into electronic healthcare records that is the issue, and the ability to access patient demographics, things like that, computer-based systems. They've all been taken offline as a precaution. But we have systems in place to revert back to what you might call old-fashioned paper-based record keeping. But as you can imagine, when a new patient arrives at the front door of the hospital, traditionally you type in her name into a computer and get all of her details. That can't happen now, so we have to do that by hand and paper. So throughput as patients come through the front door will be much slower than normal.
I'm just seeing a statement just in from the HSE, Fergal Malone. The HSE says there has been a significant ransomware attack on the HSE IT systems. They have taken the precaution of shutting down all of their IT systems in order to protect them from this attack and to allow the HSE to fully assess the situation with their security partners. The HSE apologises for the inconvenience to patients and to the public and will give further information as it becomes available, and we'll be bringing that to you throughout the programme. But that would suggest a really widespread attack is going on here, Fergal Malone, would it?
Yeah, it would certainly seem to be. We use a very common system throughout the HSE for registering patients and getting their demographics, and it is certainly seems as if that may have been the entry point or source, because if you start seeing this in other hospitals, that is the more likely explanation. Four major maternity hospitals in Ireland are already fully electronic: ourselves, National Maternity Hospital, Cork University Maternity Hospital and Kerry. So we all use the same electronic system. But beyond that, it's a hospital registration system that is common across most hospitals in Ireland. And it seems to therefore be affecting those hospitals as well.
I mean, we all know that cybercrime exists. We've all heard of, you know, such attacks on institutions before. But you'd have to be a pretty low form of human being, wouldn't you, to attack maternity hospitals' computer records?
Well, obviously, at the moment, we're putting all of our focus on keeping operations going and keeping everybody safe, which, of course, everybody is safe and services are proceeding. But we will leave it to the other authorities to pursue, once this is all resolved and we're back operational, to pursue how this happened and who the potential, where it originated from.
And what's your message to mums?
Our message is all of our patients are safe. Operations, services are completely normal. Everything is fine, except for the precaution today until we get on top of things. We're asking patients who, unless you have a critical or an urgent issue that you need our services, for example, late pregnancy issues, you're better off not coming to the hospital. So you should have an elective appointment, just a routine postnatal check, a routine antenatal check early in pregnancy, a routine scan, anything routine. If at all possible, we would ask you not to come to the hospital. We would reschedule for next week. That would give the staff time and space to ensure that we'll be able to provide all of our services to those who really need it, which is, generally speaking, late pregnancy and around the time of delivery.
What's the access that you have at the moment? You said you have a paper-based contingency. For the patients you have, inpatients you have at the moment, you're able to access their records okay?
Oh, yes. For inpatients that we have at the moment, that's all fine. We can access that. We can provide full services, everything from all of their medications and laboratories.
Blood results, all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All of that. We have paper-based systems for that. So all patients are safe. All care is being provided as normal. It's just, as you can imagine, the throughput or the pace at which you can do services when you're no longer using IT and you're back to paper will be much slower. So therefore, we're just trying to make sure that we're streamlining things and getting our focus on the inpatients and patients who really need our care. Mm-hmm. So again, if you're an outpatient and you have an urgent issue, do not hesitate to come to the hospital. We don't want patients to stay away and compromise their care. But if it's an elective appointment and you don't need our services today, it would be a great help to the hospital to stay home.
And how long do you think it might be before you're back to normal?
We're just going to go day by day at the moment. I suppose, thankfully, this is a Friday and at least general outpatient services wouldn't be working tomorrow on Sunday. As you can imagine, Anya, labour goes on 24/7, so our labour ward continues to function, and patients will come in labour throughout the weekend, and we will be well able to look after everything. But we have a whole team working on this here at the moment and been in through the night with our emergency response plan, which is fully operational at the moment.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time on such a big, busy morning, and good luck to you and your staff as you try to provide the care under these circumstances today. That's the master of the Rotunda Hospital, Fergal Malone. And as I say, we'll have more on this as we get it, and we'll bring it to you throughout the programme.
We're going to turn to some of this morning's other big news, because the Israeli military has intensified its assault on Gaza, but it says its troops have not entered the Palestinian territory. Meanwhile, Hamas has continued firing rockets into Israel. Since the start of the week, more than 100 people have been killed in Gaza and 7 have died in Israel. Najla Shawa is a mother of two who lives in Gaza City. She's been telling us that trying to keep the full horror of the situation from her children is almost impossible.
My name is Najla, and I live in Gaza City. I live with my husband and my two daughters. They're 4 and 6 years old.
What have the last few days been like for you as a family?
It's difficult to describe, because it goes like different phases of the day in between the bombardment and like airstrikes from Navy, Israeli Navy shelling and all that. And all the time in between, just trying to manage our stress, trying to manage my daughter's anxiety, because now she's really terrified. Like whenever she hears any little sound, she thinks it's an airstrike, and then she runs, and sometimes she screams. And then we go to the window to check on the smoke. Where is the smoke coming from? It's heartbreaking, and it's very difficult as a mother to manage that. And what can you explain to a 6-year-old?
And that was Najla Shawa talking last night to our reporter Joan O'Sullivan. For the latest developments, we're joined by Dan Williams, who's a senior correspondent with Reuters in Jerusalem. Dan, thanks for joining us this morning. What's been happening over the past few hours?
Well, as you noted, it's now the 5th day of fighting. The death toll in Gaza has topped 100. There seems to be a slight petering off of Palestinian rocket attacks overnight on Israel. They do persist, however. And much of the attention in Israel is now turning to two fronts. One is diplomatic efforts to achieve a ceasefire, potentially in sync with the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, which began yesterday. This would appear to be an opportune time for a reprieve, if not outright reconciliation. And indeed, the UN Secretary General called on all sides to exploit it to that end a few hours ago. The tactically, as you noted, there appears to be an intensification. There was some confusion in the press over whether a ground incursion or invasion had begun. We did not report at Reuters that it had begun. What appears to have happened is that in a slight shift of tactics, Israeli forces have been abutting the border as they've intensified attacks on what they say is an extensive bunker, command bunker and attack tunnel network in Gaza. The expectation was that Hamas and other fighters may try to launch cross-border attacks or might be flushed out of those tunnels near the border. And that seems to be what the Israelis were anticipating. I think if we are on the verge of a truce effort, Israel's interest right now, its priority will be degrading, destroying as much of Hamas's military capabilities as possible. Hamas's interest will be really having the last say, in quotes, as it were, by showing that it persisted with rocket attacks despite facing a militarily superior enemy.
One of the differences between what's been happening over the past few days and what occurred in the past seems to be the level of hostility on the streets between Jewish people and Israeli Arabs. Has that been continuing?
It has, and I think you noted that very well. This, I imagine, if it persists, will soon be called the Fourth Gaza War. In many ways, sadly, it's very familiar on that front. However, what is new here is the domestic unrest touched off within Israel. Around one-fifth, more than one-fifth of Israel's population are Arab. The vast majority of them are Muslim. Many sensitivities there align with Palestinian sensitivities, given recent unrest in Jerusalem, around a major mosque in Jerusalem. And yes, there have been what frankly can be called race riots on a nightly basis. I'm not aware of anyone being killed by Israeli police, by Israeli security forces, though they have been deploying in force. However, many ugly incidents of mob assaults on Arab motorists, Jewish motorists, synagogue set alight, accounts of mobs patrolling mixed housing areas looking for residents of the opposite of the other, in quotes, ethnic community. Very unfortunate. This has given rise to efforts, grassroots efforts, to mount reconciliation demonstrations along roadsides, along highways. As I speak, Israel's top broadcaster, called Army Radio, is hosting an unscheduled panel with a rabbi and Israeli Arab lawmaker. So there is a knock-on effect, happily, among people trying to restore some sort of coexistence, because this does seem to be rather tenuous right now in many parts of the country.
Dan, many thanks for joining us this morning. Dan Williams there, who's a senior correspondent with Reuters in Jerusalem.
But right now, let's talk about Anglo-Irish relations. And it's been a tough week overall. Boris Johnson's apology for the Ballymurphy massacre pretty much backfired. The row over the Northern Ireland Protocol continues. And it's against all of this backdrop that Taoiseach Micheál Martin travels to Chequers today for a summit with the British Prime Minister. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham has more. Now, this meeting, it's not on foot of this week's developments, but it does come at a critical time, Paul. What progress does the Irish side hope can be made?
Well, good relations is a key strategy for the Irish government to maintain those good relations with our nearest neighbour, to find out and engage on the question of Brexit and what implications are going to be for Northern Ireland, and then also upkeeping historic agreements like the Stormont House Agreement, which was negotiated in 2014, and obviously had things like the Historical Investigations Unit, which meant that what happened in the past was going to be investigated by the police. So there's multiple issues which Ireland has a vested interest in, and ensuring that those good relations maintain. So because of COVID, we haven't had such a meeting since last August, but it's going to happen today at Chequers, which is that country retreat of the Prime Minister about 60 kilometres outside of London.
And presumably one of the first items on the agenda is going to be the Ballymurphy apology that appears to have caused more hurt and anger than soothing the grief, and also the proposed amnesty for troubles crimes in breach of the Stormont House Agreement.
Yeah, on Ballymurphy, I mean, the significant thing from the families was that those 10 people who were shot and killed had been proven to be innocent. But I think it would be fair to describe it as a cack-handed response by the British Prime Minister, following on from that verdict, in which he sent a letter with to the 10 families, not individually, but all 10 of them, that it was Brandon Lewis who walked into the House of Commons and gave the apology rather than the Prime Minister himself, and managed to anger people who had been very happy and delighted with the actual legal outcome itself. And then, as you said, there is that issue of an amnesty, which effectively rides roughshod over the Stormont House Agreement, because it's effectively saying that those historical killings are not going to be investigated. First, that came out in a number of newspapers, but it was confirmed in the Queen's speech on Tuesday. Now, the Queen's speech is something that's written by the British government rather than the Queen Elizabeth herself, but she went on to say it is clear that the current system for dealing with the legacy of the past is not working well for anyone, with criminal investigations increasingly unlikely to deliver successful criminal justice outcomes and failing to obtain answers for a majority of victims and families. Right. And on foot of that observation, effectively what they seem to be doing is to wrapping up the possibility of former British officers being prosecuted for actions that they took while on tours of duty in Northern Ireland. And that's a huge, significant issue for the Irish government.
Another huge, significant issue is the Northern Ireland Protocol. Of course, the Unionist Court challenge begins separately today. But in terms of the negotiations that are going on, Lord David Frost, the man who negotiated the protocol and then said this week it wasn't sustainable, will he be at this summit today?
We haven't got all of the details on yet. It's possible, because he's also a member of cabinet and this is a key particular issue. And as everyone knows, he helped negotiate the Brexit deal, which he now says part of it, that Northern Ireland Protocol, isn't functioning. I think you always have to look at that between what is said officially and then what's happening on the ground. And it does appear that the UK government is working aspects of the protocol. There are committees meeting on really exciting issues like pig meat and how tests can be to conduct it between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, which won't cause problems for goods arriving into shops. So there's a bit of rhetoric going on, but underneath that there is also a clear sign that the UK government is not walking away from the protocol, is actually working the protocol, even though politicians from a unionist perspective in Northern Ireland want to actually smash it.
All right, our political correspondent Paul Cunningham reporting on what's to come at Chequers today.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Morning Ireland, coming up to 22 minutes to 8. Des has the sports news.
Yeah, hi Anya. We're going to start with last night's big game at Old Trafford. Jurgen Klopp celebrated his first win there as Liverpool beat Manchester United 4-2 to boost Liverpool's chances of a Champions League place. A very exciting game. United scored early on through Bruno Fernandes' deflected shot. Liverpool, though, hit back. Diogo Jota scored, and then Roberto Firmino scored twice either side of half time. 3-1 to Liverpool. Marcus Rashford pulled a goal back for United, but Mo Salah wrapped up the points with the late breakaway goal for his 21st goal of the season. The result takes Liverpool to fifth in the Premier League. They have a game in hand, but they're still 4 points behind Chelsea and 6 points behind Leicester. However, Chelsea still have to play Leicester, so at least one of them will drop points there. If Liverpool win their remaining three games, they could easily qualify again for the Champions League. Here's their defender, Nate Phillips.
Well, yeah, it just makes it more interesting, doesn't it? But we can't look away from our own camp too much because we can't have an effect on that. The other teams will do what they do. All we can affect is the games that we play in. So no matter what happens elsewhere in the league, we've got to concentrate on doing our jobs.
What does this give you for those remaining games, though, tonight?
Something to build on and learn from. You know, we started too slow, so we can learn from that and know that we can't do that in the future games, but obviously take confidence from it that we managed to bring ourselves back into the game, manage the game at the end like we've struggled to do in a few previous games. So plenty, but like I said, we can't focus on tonight too much. We've got to turn our focus onto the next few games and finish the job that we've got ahead of us.
They play West Brom now on Sunday. And last night's other game, Aston Villa and Everton, played out a dull, scoreless draw. At home in tonight's Premier Division games, Dundalk travel to Finn Harps, while Drogheda host St Patrick's Athletic. There's also lots of action in rugby's Rainbow Cup. Munster play Connacht and Leinster host Ulster. Ulster haven't won in 13 visits to Leinster. In golf, the Irish players are right in the mix at the top of the Byron Nelson Classic leaderboard. Jordan Spieth and JJ Spaun lead on 9 under par, but Seamus Power is 7 under, Paul de Carrington is 6 under. And going into day 3 at the British Masters, Greystone's Paul Dunne also in contention. He's 4 shots off the lead. It's another extensive weekend of inter-county GA action in the Alliance Leagues. We'll be looking ahead to the beginning of the Football League later with Tomás, but for his views on week 2 of the hurling now, let's hear from Don Lowe Cusack.
Good morning, Des. We had an entertaining opening round of fixtures to the Hurling League last weekend, and the coming couple of days promises more of the same. Limerick are being set up as unbeatable by most pundits. We haven't seen them lose a top flight game since the summer of 2019, in many respects seeming such a long time ago, so the confidence is understandable. Having said that, they travelled to Salthill on Sunday to face one team who appear to have the artillery to trouble them. It's always hard to know with Galway, but expect them to want to lay down a marker to the champions here. Tip and Cork meet in Thurles. There were positive signs from Cork last Sunday against Waterford. Maybe it's a case Cork aren't as good in Waterford as bad as the results suggested. Time will tell. For a league game, Tippin appeared to invest more than usual against Limerick 6 days ago, and a draw was a satisfactory return. These old firm meetings rarely disappoint. Kilkenny host Antrim in Division 1B. Antrim on a roll at the moment. Kilkenny are never impressed by that sort of thing. Based on last weekend, if Antrim win this one, our friends in the north may become our noisy neighbours. More power to them. However, the pick of the games must be in Cusick Park, Innes. Clare versus Wexford is more subplots than an Agatha Christie novel. This is Game of Thrones-esque, bringing together an ensemble cast full of big characters. Plenty intrigue, no shortage of backstabbing, with hurling added instead of sex, which is even better, Des.
There's a line for the weekend to keep you going. Thanks, Donal Cusick. In cycling, a fine display from Dan Martin saw him take third place on stage 6 of the Giro d'Italia. He's up to 9th overall now, 40 seconds off the new leader Attila Valter of Hungary, 47 seconds at the gap. In racing, Hurricane Lane won the Dante Stakes at York for jockey William Buick and trainer Charles Appleby. The action continues at York today, and there's also racing at Leopardstown and at Kilbeggan.
Democratic Unionist Party due to elect a new leader today. The Stormont Agriculture Minister Edwin Poots and Lagan Valley MP Geoffrey Donaldson are vying to replace Arlene Foster. Columnist and commentator Alex Kane joins us on the line. Alex, thanks for being with us this morning. Who gets to decide this contest and how close is it?
Well, morning. It's very close, and that's going to be what your listeners need to know. That only 36 people make this decision, the DUPs, 28 MLAs and their 8 MPs. It's a very, very small selectorate, which means that the outcome is going to be very tight, partly because there isn't a huge amount of difference between Donaldson and Poots. But for both of them, they still have... One of the reasons the DUP got rid of Arlene Foster was they thought that she was... They wanted a scapegoat for the protocol. But simply getting rid of her and replacing her with one of these two men doesn't remove the protocol. It is still a huge problem for unionism. And all the way through this, we've had this campaign for 2 weeks. Well, both of them have upped the ante in terms of, oh, well, if the Assembly has to collapse, we'll consider that. And, you know, we'll continue to fight this. We'll maybe have some battle over North-South links and so on. The fact remains, Rachel, that neither of them has the power to remove the protocol. That requires Boris Johnson. It requires the EU. And so far, there's no sign that either of those bodies is willing to make the changes the DUP want.
As you say, though, Alex, from both camps, there have been a considerable number of promises and threats about the protocol.
Well, and that's the difficulty. We've seen this since, you need to go back, the protocol was first mentioned, I think, September 2019, over 18 months ago. There were protests just before COVID kicked in, there were quite a few protests across Northern Ireland from unionism and loyalism. Then there was still some hope. The DUP, the Ulster unionists, were saying, oh, we'll negotiate, we'll talk, we'll maybe get this toned back or removed altogether. That didn't happen. Came in at the beginning of January. Unionism, very angry. And I think it's important, some people just think, why are they so angry over, you know, what's basically just some sort of trading economic line? It's more than that. For unionists, see this, it's a perception that somehow this is a new line of separation between Northern Ireland unionism and Great Britain. And that's why the anger is there. And the problem is, though, that it goes back to what I just said. You know, you can make as many promises as you like. You can threaten as many actions as you like. You can have protests on the streets. You can have debates. You can have anger. You can have some sort of, oh, let's not do this, let's not do that. But when it comes down to it, Rachel, the DUP, the UUP, loyalism, unionism, collectively, singly, they do not have the power to do anything about it. And the danger is, of course, that in ratcheting this up, just as we're heading into what's known in Northern Ireland as the marching season, that creates problems where the leader, whoever becomes leader, may find themselves, if they ratchet this up too much, they may find themselves pushed or nudged or just thrown into some sort of cul-de-sac, which will give them even more problems in a few months' time.
Geoffrey Donaldson of the two is probably the better known in the South. Is he still the favourite?
Favourite in the sense that we're looking at, it could be a tie. There's some people from both camps are telling me it's that close. Both camps are telling me that if their man wins, it's going to be by one or two votes. You're looking at 2016, 1917, and that in itself is a problem, Rachel, because the Democratic Unionist Party has never, ever had a vote. It's never had any real division within the party exposed. If either of these men wins by that very tiny majority, the first question every journalist will ask them, don't you lead a divided party? And a leader leading a divided party, it really does limit his room for manoeuvre, because if he moves one way, the people who voted for him might go, well, we're not sure, but the people who voted against him will be angry. That anger is picked up outside the party. It's amplified across loyalism and the loyalist communities, council and organisations like that, and the Orange Order. And again, that makes it very difficult for whichever one of them wins. If they want to show a little bit of pragmatism, and both these men, it is worth saying, Rachel, both these men are capable of pragmatism, but mm-hmm. pragmatism is almost impossible when you lead a party by just maybe one vote.
Alex Kane, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
And just as we came on air at 7, news was breaking of a cyber attack on the Rotunda Maternity Hospital, and we've learned from the HSE in the past half hour of a significant ransomware attack on their IT system. HSE Chief Executive Paul Reid is on the line. Good morning, Paul Reid.
Good morning, Anya.
We heard from the master of the Rotunda Hospital. They noticed overnight there was a problem with their IT system. They've cancelled the outpatient appointments for women under 36 weeks pregnant. But this isn't just maternity hospitals. This is HSE wide, is it?
Yeah, good morning. Just want to give you context of what actually we know has happened so far and what we're doing. So first of all, this is a we have been the subject of a very significant major ransomware attack. It's quite a very sophisticated attack, and that will be just a kind of standard attack. So it's very sophisticated. It is impacting all of our national and local systems that would be involved in all of our core services. We did become aware of it during the night, and we've been obviously acting on it straight away. The immediate priority is obviously to contain this, but it is what we call a kind of human-operated ransomware attack, where they would seek to get access to data. And obviously, you know, seek a ransom for it. So it's quite a significant one, quite a serious one. We've taken a precautionary measure to shut down a lot of our major systems to protect them. We have sought and have already got the support of the national security and IT systems. We are working with all of our major IT security providers, and the national security cyber team are involved. They have been alerted. You know, so that would be the major state supports, including Garda, Defence Forces, and third-party cyber support teams. So, obviously, we do apologise for the impacts of what it's had, but we are at the very early stages of fully understanding the threat, the impacts, and trying to contain.
Has there been a ransom demand?
Not at this stage. Again, I have to be very careful I say this on these incidents. I've dealt with them before in previous roles, and the first and obviously key thing which you have to do is contain the issue. That's what all our focus is throughout the night. And since early this morning, we've all been at it, involved in our own national crisis management team, because it is a major incident for us. So as the morning progresses, we'll get greater clarity on the issue and greater clarity of the impacts and greater clarity of the next steps we are taking. But, you know, we are in a major information capture stage and containment phase at this stage.
You say it's sophisticated, human-operated, and all national and local systems are affected across all core services. Give us some examples of how extensive that is, what that means.
Well, yeah, and indeed you had the master of the Rotunda on this morning, which does set out some of the impacts in terms of the information in terms of patients as they were coming, and we would access, you know, in a normal manner to the systems just to get the patient data, how that would work across the various services. So, you know, health patients, departments, yeah, some of the impacts that it would have. Now, again, during the course of the morning, once we become clearer of what those impacts are, we will continue with national, and indeed the individual services themselves will be communicating with patients. What I can say, and what I do want to reassure everybody you're listening this morning, is the vaccination program continues, not impacted. So everybody should still come forward. Indeed, everybody should still come forward until they hear something different from us in terms of services mm-hmm. impact. So just say that firstly, but vaccination program continues. It's a separate system on a separate infrastructure. So that continues, thankfully. So, you know, we will be communicating out regularly. I'm very anxious just to come in and advise you this morning just of the impacts as we know just now. But we will have more information, and we will continue to continue.
Absolutely, and we appreciate that, and thank you for doing that. You are shutting down a lot of your major systems, but what do the Rotunda have said? They have advised women under 36 weeks pregnant, unless there's an emergency, not to turn up for appointments today, regular appointments today. What is the advice if anyone else has an outpatient appointment in any other hospital around the country, maternity or otherwise?
Yeah, thanks. And look, I expect over the next hour we'll certainly have greater clarity on the impacts on all of the systems and all of the services. But right now, I would say, unless and until people hear from us, we do expect more regular communications over the next hour about the impacts on each of the services. So unless until people hear, please do come forward. But over the next hour, we will have some greater communications on the impact. This is really a very evolving situation over the last few hours. And, you know, I appreciate everybody is anxious, and we are very anxious, but we will continue with communications out. So please come forward as people have appointments for now, but we will be communicating out further in the very next short while.
But, and you know, sometimes people have to travel a long way for a hospital appointment. If somebody's setting out this morning, should they wait for more information?
Yeah, I would say, certainly, you know, this is probably in the last 3 hours of which we're seeing the understanding of the impacts and the attacks. So, you know, it is an evolving situation, and I'd like to have had full information just now, but I am anxious to get as much as we have out right now. But for now, I mean, people, and particularly people in need of urgent care services, all continue. Will be impacted, obviously, in terms of, as the Master of the Rotunda was talking this morning, in terms of impacts as people come forward and not being able to access IT systems does impact on efficiency. But, you know, a very evolving situation, Anya, and as I say, we will have further information once we have it.
All right. Perhaps, I don't know, maybe if you do get more information, because obviously it's an evolving situation, we may be able to get a couple of minutes with you or get another update from you before 9 o'clock. You're working with Gardaí, Defence Forces and Cyber Security. A major, I mean, yes, let me clarify one thing. The Master of the Rotunda said that the life-saving equipment they use in the delivery suites, the premature baby is not affected. What about intensive care units, machines, you know, that are really important in treating people and keeping them healthy and alive? Are they okay?
Yeah, I mean, what we expect is most of the infrastructure in our hospitals and acute hospital systems would be based on a dedicated local infrastructure. So it's not, this is more or less information technology systems and transferring of information across networks. So most of those will be on standalone infrastructure. We'd expect to be, you know, fine and working in operation. And all our indications are that that is the case. So it's largely what is stored on central servers, what is transferred across central servers between networks and between infrastructure is where the impacts as we assess them right now.
All right. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for giving us that information. That's the Chief Executive of the HSE, Paul Reid.
Stock markets across the world have been taking a bit of a hammering this week amid worries that US inflation is set to rise. While US shares did rebound yesterday, investors remain fearful that central banks will increase interest rates if prices continue to overheat. If that does happen, investors will shift from shares to less risky assets like bonds. Paul Somerville of Somerville Advisory Markets joins us on the line. The stock markets have been having a bit of a wobble this week, Paul. Why is the selling pressure coming now?
Yeah, well, investors are getting a very good lesson in how stock markets are a forward pricing mechanism. It's not pricing in what is happening today. It's rather trying to guess and anticipate what's going to happen in the second half of the year. We've had very, very strong data. The US GDP was up 6.4% in the first quarter, and we've just had earnings season. Extremely strong earnings from, say, Apple. Revenue growth up 53%, Facebook up 47%. So really strong earnings, yet all these stock prices are trading lower than where they were. Apple is down around 15% from where it was in January. And that is because the markets are trying to price in inflation expectations that are looking to be stronger and bond yields are ticking higher. So we're expecting the second half of the year to be very, very volatile, very similar to what happened in 2018. Markets are anticipating inflation, anticipating interest rates to be going higher. And that is why the high price stocks are wobbling somewhat.
And the Federal Reserve has been trying to keep interest rates low to bolster the economy. Is it likely to move now? It's very much trying to calm inflation fears by saying these price pressures won't last.
Well, we can see the consumer price inflation earlier in the week was 4.2% annualised. That's the highest since 2008. The Fed says this is all transitory, but the market doesn't believe it. The market thinks that stagflation is coming, meaning high inflation and low growth. So they are pushing up interest rates anyway. And it's important to realise that the market sets interest rates, not the Federal Reserve, and bond yields are ticking higher. And that is bad news for very, you know, tech stocks, while it's relatively good news for some of the cyclical stocks like banks and oil stocks and things like that.
Bitcoin dropped as much as 15% yesterday, but for a different reason. Tesla CEO Elon Musk said it will no longer accept Bitcoin for car purchases. What impact is this going to have on the cryptocurrency going forward, Paul?
Yeah, well, we can see that Bitcoin is always very volatile. I wouldn't take too much heed into what Elon Musk says about anything. I would say, suggest that he's trying to deflect from very poor Chinese car sales that Tesla had during the week. And we can see this morning that he's talking about other types of cryptocurrencies, and they've been going up this morning. So I would take it all with a grain of salt.
Okay, Paul Somerville of Somerville Advisory Markets, thanks for joining us.
The Irish Times reports in its lead story that the summit meeting between the Taoiseach Micheál Martin and the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson in Chequers, the Prime Minister's country of residence, today is expected to be dominated by discussions on the legacy of the Troubles and on the Northern Ireland Protocol. The two Northern papers give prominence to the leadership election in the Democratic Unionist Party, also taking place today. The Irish News says that Geoffrey Donaldson, MP, is odds-on favourite. He has said that if he wins, he hopes to become First Minister. This means he would run in the next Assembly election, triggering a Westminster by-election. The Belfast Telegraph reports that Mr. Donaldson and his rival Edwin Poots are engaged in a flurry of last-minute telephone conversations and meetings with MLAs in the final 24 hours of the race. The main story for the Irish Independent is that the government's own research warned in 2019 that cuckoo funds were unlikely to help boost the supply of affordable housing, but could instead develop monopolistic power in parts of the market they came to dominate. In other property news, the Irish Daily Mail describes as a bonanza for home buyers the 20-year fixed-rate mortgage launched by Finance Ireland. Best of all, says the paper, the non-bank lender is backed by taxpayer cash, as the state-owned Strategic Investment Fund has a 30% stake in Finance Ireland. RTE's Lucky Stars is the headline in the Irish Daily Star over a report that Gardaí have said that staff at RTE will not face charges over a retirement gathering at the station last November during Level 5 restrictions, or, as the paper calls it, the infamous party. The Irish Examiner leads with a claim by the ISPCC that social media platforms are allowing the continued cyberbullying of children by refusing to take meaningful action when complaints are made. The Irish Sun reports in its lead story that a 13-year-old boy has been questioned about what the paper calls a horror attack at Howth Junction Dart Station in Dublin. The paper says that he and two 16-year-old youths, one of them a promising footballer, were arrested yesterday morning over an incident at the station last month in which a girl fell from a platform. All three were later released without charge. The matter gets much coverage elsewhere. The Irish Independent reports that Gardaí carried out searches of five properties in North Dublin yesterday on foot of warrants, and that Gardaí are continuing their investigation of the incidents. In other stories, the Examiner reports that the Minister of State for Justice, Hildegard Nocton, has admitted sharing some of her constituents' data outside of the Oireachtas to a private email account over an extended period from 2016. Aoife Moore writes that among the details being shared without constituent knowledge were names, addresses, contact details, queries and supporting documents, as well as other private information. After an investigation by the Examiner, the Minister's office admitted that the practice had taken place but said it had now ceased. The death of the writer and university teacher Seamus Dean is widely noted. The Times quotes the President as saying his death is an incalculable loss to Irish critical writing. As the paper recalls, Dean was a friend and classmate of Seamus Heaney's at St. Columb's College in Derry. The writer and political activist Eamon McCann is quoted as having once said, "Seamus Dean was the best soccer player in St. Columb's. Then he fell in with the wrong crowd and became a poet."
And as we've been hearing, the computer systems that help to run the country's hospitals and healthcare services have been hit by a major cyber attack. Because of this, the HSE has had to shut down its systems. The chief executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, told us that the attack was human operated and very sophisticated. Well, news is emerging all the while, but for an update, let's talk to our reporter, Sinead Spain. Sinead, at this stage, what do we know?
We know that sometime during the night, the HSE became aware of a major cybersecurity attack impacting national and local systems and affecting core systems across the HSE. A major incident response has been put in place. All records have been shut down as a precaution. The National Security Cyber Team has been alerted, and this involves the Gardaí, the Defence Forces and the IT partners that work with the HSE and that build their system. We know that the attack impacts all patient records, so it was an attack on the data rather than on the machinery, so life-saving equipment is not impacted by this. And the CEO of the HSE, Paul Reid, says that we will know more later, but he has described it as a massive attack.
We have been the subject of a very significant major ransomware attack. It's quite a very sophisticated attack, and that will be just a kind of standard attack. So it's very sophisticated. It is impacting all of our national and local systems that would be involved in all of our core services. We did become aware of it during the night, and we've been obviously acting on it straight away. The immediate priority is obviously to contain this, but it is what we call a kind of human-operated ransomware attack, where they would seek to get access to data. And obviously, you know, seek a ransom for it. So it's quite a significant one, quite a serious one. We've taken a precautionary measure to shut down a lot of our major systems to protect them. We have sought and have already got the support of the national security and IT systems. We are working with all of our major IT security providers, and the national security cyber team are involved. They have been alerted. You know, so that would be the major state supports, including Garda, Defence Forces and third-party cyber support teams. So obviously we do apologise for the impacts of what it's had, but we are at the very early stages of fully understanding the threat, the impacts and trying to contain.
That was Paul Reid, the chief executive of the HSE, talking to us a short time ago. Sinead, do we know how many patients or hospitals are likely to be affected today?
We don't know at this stage, but what we do know is, as we heard there, it is a widespread and significant attack. So the HSE says they will begin to alert patients in the next hour or so when they know more about the extent of it, but we would expect widespread cancellations. The Rotunda Hospital in Dublin has cancelled all of its outpatient appointments, and people are asked, in particular for the Rotunda, do not attend unless it is an emergency. The only exception is for anyone who is 36 weeks pregnant or in case of emergency. And Professor Fergal Malone had this advice this morning for women with appointments today.
It basically means that we've had to shut down all of our computer systems. Now, thankfully, we have contingency plans in place for this, that the hospital can function absolutely normally using a paper-based system. But obviously, throughput will be much slower. So all patients in the hospital are safe, all the care is being provided, there's no problems for patient safety. But as a precaution, we're asking all patients who have appointments at the Rotunda today to not attend the hospital unless it's an emergency or unless they're 36 weeks pregnant or over. All equipment such as that are all absolutely operational and fine. It's computers logging into electronic healthcare records that is the issue.
And that was Professor Fergal Malone of the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. Our thanks to Sinead Spain for that report. By the way, one area we know that hasn't been affected is the COVID vaccination system. So at the moment, the news is that vaccinations will go ahead today as normal. Let's talk now to Brian Honan, who's a cybersecurity expert and former special advisor on cybersecurity to Europol. Brian, thanks very much for talking to us. Let's start with the basics. What is a ransomware attack?
Yeah, good morning, Rachel. A ransomware attack is where criminals use a computer virus to infect your computers. And once they trigger the virus, it encrypts or scrambles all your data so that you can't access it. And then they demand a ransom, an extortion fee from you to give you the password to recover your data from. So it's an attack where they make your information unavailable and literally hold it to ransom.
And from what we've been hearing over the past hour or so since this story broke, what do you make of what's happening here?
Yeah, look, this is a major attack by all accounts. It's heartening to hear from Paul Reid and HSE and the chief of the Rotunda Hospital how their business continuity plans have been able to kick in and that they're able to continue ordinary operations, albeit at a slower pace because it is paper-based, but and that they've taken systems offline as a precaution to stop the ransom virus spreading any further within the systems. So they've taken the proactive and positive steps, and hopefully the attack can be contained and dealt with over the next few days. But look, we have seen this happen in other countries. The people behind these attacks are criminals. Their only motive is to make money. They don't care who they impact or who they hurt. And they've hit hospitals in other countries. They've hit health services in other countries, educational services, etc. And, you know, I think it does say a lot about the type of people who conduct these attacks that they do this type of stuff to hospitals and healthcare in the middle of a pandemic.
So is it likely then that the people behind this, that they will be getting in touch in some way with the HSE to say, listen, this is what we've done and this is what we're looking for?
Yeah, that's typically how it works, is that there may be looking to contact the HSE in some way. Typically, it's a message left on one of the impacted machines. It'll give them details of an email address to contact that they can communicate with the criminals, or a website that they can go to communicate with them through that. And it'll probably contain the ransom demand as to how much money they're looking for and how they expect to be paid, which will be generally through cryptocurrencies, typically something like Bitcoin, etc., to transfer the money off to them.
How can this be resolved?
There are several ways you can resolve it. If you're lucky, your backups are up to date and haven't been affected by the criminals. Sometimes what the criminals do is when they access your network, they will spend time on your network and corrupt your backups so that when they do trigger the ransomware software, that it you go to recovery backups, it's not there. So if, you know, as I said, hopefully the backups have not been impacted and the data can be restored from that. If the backups have been impacted, then the options are to not pay the ransom and rebuild your systems from scratch as best you can. Or unfortunately, a decision may have to be made whether or not to pay the ransom to try to get the data back. But we should be very wary. You are dealing with criminals. By their nature, they're not the most trustworthy people in the world. And there's no guarantee, even if you pay the ransom, that you will get your data back, or that if you pay the ransom, that there's no additional costs or impact on the information that as a result of the attack.
Just one final question, Brian. We're talking here, in some cases, about quite sensitive information. Is there a danger that people's data, their personal information, has been compromised?
Yeah. Yeah, there is, Rachel. Some of the criminal gangs, they do what's called a double extortion attack. So your information is held to ransom by the ransomware and you have to pay to get it back. And then the criminals also threaten to release the data they've got during the attack onto the internet, and they will demand a payment for that to prevent that from happening. And we've seen a case of recently in Finland where a psychiatric hospital was impacted by such an attack that their data was ransomed, the payment was demanded to release their data, and also payment demanded not to post the data onto the internet.
Brian, thank you very much. And of course, I should say that at this moment, it's entirely unclear whether anything like that has happened or will happen. But as Brian was saying to us there, it's a possibility. That was Brian Honan, cybersecurity expert and former special advisor on cybersecurity to Europol.
Israel says its air and ground troops struck Gaza in the heaviest attacks yet overnight. There's fear of a ground invasion, and there has been more ugly communal violence between Jews and Arabs on Israeli streets. There is no sign of progress on a ceasefire. Our reporter Joan O'Sullivan has been speaking to some people in Gaza and Tel Aviv about the dreadful times they're living through. And you might find some of the accounts you'll hear in the next couple of minutes upsetting. Leila Barhoum works for Oxfam in Gaza City, and she says, in a place so densely populated, everyone suffers when there are military strikes.
Today is a really sad day, and it's full with fear and anticipation of what will be happening, and full with worries. And it's full with sounds, drones, airstrikes. You can hear one right now. It's like this since the morning, but at the same time, it's a day where we are trying together as a family to celebrate Eid.
Are you safe right now as you speak to me?
Yes, I am safe. They are pretty far, but I mean, whatever can happen now, the only thing I can do is just stay where I am.
What kind of night lies ahead?
Sleepless evening. It's the nights and evenings that are dreadful the most, because the sound intensifies, and most of the airstrikes take place at night. At least when there is light and it's daytime, you see around you and you can tell where is the black smoke. Now it's night, you can't tell where it is, and the sounds doesn't tell you. So I see sleepless nights, scared children, and we are sitting together in one room and waiting to see what will happen until the sun rises.
Israel says it is only striking military targets in Gaza.
I would say the people I saw run away in the streets from the airstrikes are children and women and civilians. I have seen armed people running. It was women and children, and they were crying and screaming. They were running down the stairs from apartment buildings. If they are military targets, then why did we have women having their nightgown on and running in the streets and holding their babies? We need just to see who's running from the strike, and then this will tell us who has been targeted. And this is a very dense area. When you hit a place, the radius of the impact is big, because we are talking about excessive use of power. We are talking about heavy military equipment being used in targeting.
Leila Barhoum talking to Joan O'Sullivan about living in Gaza City this past week. Joan also spoke to Maram Faresh, a 23-year-old graduate and writer.
You know, it's real horrific. I've never felt this horror before. I felt like I will be the next one. You know what I mean? I just panicked. You know, I can't sleep. I can't sleep all night. I always wear my hijab. So if I would die, I will die with my hijab. You can't do anything. You are just sitting here in your room waiting for your death.
Maram, what have you seen yourself over the last day or two?
In the first day of the attack, I was at my aunt's home. My mom wanted us to go to our home so we can be together. So when the taxi it was driving us, I saw a funeral, you know, funeral of three young people. Then the air drones just bombed a target, and the target were children. I saw them. I saw their blood. I saw their remains, to be specific. It was really heartbreaking to see these innocent children getting killed and getting torn into pieces. You know, they were angels, and now they are just vanished just because they are Palestinians. It's really horrible. I can't describe what I'm feeling right now.
That was Maram Faresh in Gaza. Across the border, Paul Carnes is an Irishman living in Tel Aviv. He told Joan the situation there is surreal right now.
You're running to the shelters in the building every few hours, and you're waiting for the next siren. And at the same time, you have to live life normally. You're going out to the supermarket. You're feeding the kids. Yet you're waiting constantly. And when the siren goes off and you're running to the shelter, the thunderous noise of the rockets being intercepted above you is terrifying. And yet you know, life goes on. It's the weird normality of having to do normal things, you know, Zoom classes with the university, going to the supermarket, you know, watching Peppa the Pig with the four-year-old, and then the alarm goes off and you grab her and you run downstairs and you don't know what to say to her. Then the alarm is off and the big booms stop and you come back up and what do you want for dinner?
Is there a sense of shock about how quickly this all escalated and this is the situation you're now in?
Yes and no. There's a joke going around in Israel or Tel Aviv. Oh, you know, life's back to normal, COVID's over and war has started.
That was Paul Kearns, an Irishman living in Tel Aviv, talking to Joan O'Sullivan about the violence of the past week.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
I like a good build-up, I do. Anyway, let's start with last night's football action, and Jurgen Klopp celebrated his first win at Old Trafford as Liverpool beat Manchester United 4-2 to boost Liverpool's chances of a Champions League place. In a thrilling game, United struck first through Bruno Fernandes, but Liverpool hit back. Diogo Jota equalised and Roberto Firmino scored twice either side of half-time. Marcus Rashford got a goal for United, so it's back to 3-2. But then Mo Salah wrapped up the points for Liverpool while United had been applying pressure, and it finished 4-2 to Liverpool. It takes Liverpool to fifth in the Premier League table. They have a game in hand, but they're still 4 points behind Chelsea and 6 points behind Leicester. However, Chelsea still have to play Leicester next week, so at least one of them will drop points. If Liverpool win their remaining three games, they could easily qualify for the Champions League again. Here's their manager, Jurgen Klopp.
Great, great fight, good game, intense, how derby should be. And our first, since I'm at Liverpool, the first win at Old Trafford, good timing, I would say. We needed it, obviously. We fought hard for it, we deserved it, and so all good.
And let's hear what Manchester United manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had to say.
They deserved the win. We conceded goals in bad moments of the key moments of the game. You know, just before halftime, just after the second half started, and of course towards the end. We didn't call it build on the momentum or break up momentum. First 10, 15 minutes, I thought we played really well. We should have built on that momentum and maybe pushed more. And then we give him three goals, really. At least two of them we give him. And then when we score again, we've got momentum. We have a massive double chance there. So key moments went against us.
In last night's other game, Aston Villa and Everton played out a dull scoreless draw at Villa Park. And tonight, in the Premier Division games at home, Dundalk travel to Finn Harps, while Drogheda host St Patrick's Athletic in England. Manchester City play Newcastle. There's also action tonight in rugby's Rainbow Cup. Munster hosting Connacht, and Leinster are at home to Ulster. And remember, Ulster haven't won on their last 13 visits to Leinster. In golf, the Irish players are right in the mix at the top of the leaderboard in the Byron Nelson Classic. Jordan Spieth and JJ Spaun lead on 9 under par. Seamus Power is 7 under, Padraig Harrington 6 under. And as day 3 of the British Masters is underway, Greystone's Paul Dunne is also in the mix. He's 4 shots off the lead. Well, Gaelic games next, and it's another extensive weekend of intercounty action in the Allianz League. Let's look ahead to the beginning of the Football League now with the Niger, Tomás O'Shea.
Yeah, Des, it's brilliant. We're elite again. We can go back playing. You know, everybody found the last few months tough, but this football back gives us something to grab onto. It gives us kind of hope. It gives us a chance to argue with people, to talk to people. And, you know, all the teams have a hope of building something special again for the year ahead. You don't have to win the league to get that kind of victory within, and I think that's the big thing about the league. It might be watered down. You know, there's only 4 matches. We might not see a final depending on who's in it and when they're out in the championship, but I think it will be exciting. You know, it's probably toughest on the Division 3 and 4 teams, as they might not feel as confident about championship because of being a knockout, and they set their achievable goals for the year in the league. And then you look at some games, they've only 3 matches, and then Waterford, Carlow, Wexford, because London are not there, they've only 2 matches. So So it is tough on them, I feel. But the GAA have done well. I think any sort of a league or championship organised is good. There will be a lot of the playoff matches as well. There's something we might have going forward. You know, you see it in the soccer abroad, how big they are. And for the all-important two tiers that will be coming in, Division 2 and 3 is vital. So we'll be watching that. They've only four matches to ensure that they don't go up or down. Dublin, they won't fret about the league. They don't have to. But, you know, we'll be looking at Galway, we'll be looking at Kerry, we'll be looking at Tyrone, Donegal. You know, they'll want to find form, they'll want to find have their settled teams, they'll want to hit the ground running. And if they can find that consistency, it will mean everything for them going into championship. So the league is vital for those types of teams. And it can go the other way as well. I think the proximity of the league to championship is brilliant, Des. You know, the form you see in the league will carry into championship. So you need to get that form. Will the challengers step up? We'll see. You know, this weekend alone, I can't wait. I'm going to Tralee and Kerry and Galway. Galway are starting four new young fellas. The two Cliffords are starting. David's brother is starting, so that'll be interesting. Armagh in Division 1. We have Donegal, Tyrone, and then in Division 4 we have Mickey Hart, McGinley, and Tony McEntee with Sligo, and they're all going head to head. So there's a brilliant feast of football for the weekend, and the whole country will be buzzing with it, Des. So I can't wait for it.
All right, thanks to us. We'll have extensive coverage, of course, here on RT Radio 1. 7 hours tomorrow, Saturday Sport, Sunday Sport have all the games, as well as GAA Go. Now, in cycling, a fine display from Dan Martin saw him take third place on Stage 6 of the Giro d'Italia. He's up to ninth place overall, 47 seconds behind the new overall leader, Attila Valter of Hungary. In racing, Hurricane Lane won the Dante Stakes at York, and the action continues at York today. There's also racing at Leopardstown and at Kilbeggan.
Ireland's travel restrictions are outdated, inappropriate and unnecessary, according to Ryanair. They're calling for an end to travel restrictions on UK and EU flights from the end of the month, including the mandatory hotel quarantine system. Their chief executive, Eddie Wilson, is on the line. Eddie Wilson, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
I suppose it's no surprise that you think this, because we've heard from you about the travel restrictions throughout the pandemic. Do you believe government will listen now?
I think they have to. I mean, it's not necessarily just what Ryanair is saying. I mean, we've been saying it for a long time. But, you know, Paul Reid this morning from the HSE is out saying that the link is now broken between, you now have high vaccination levels. We're going to have 80% of the population or the adult population done by the end of June. And in aviation, you need those signposts now. I mean, mandatory hotel quarantine, fine for outside the European Union where you can actually control it, but you can't control it in a common travel area between either the UK or between countries on the European continent. And last week we had Italy and Austria lifted. We still have France and Belgium, and they need to be lifted, because all of that happens is that airlines don't fly there, and people who want to fly to Ireland just go to other third countries and fly in. We need that signpost like now. It's the right time to do it, and we hope that they'll actually respond to this.
The Chequers summit today between the Taoiseach and Boris Johnson, they'll be talking about COVID cooperation. Do you hope that there could be news about the resumption of the common travel area out of that meeting?
I think so. I mean, and you know, it's, you know, you have the Taoiseach travelling there today. There's lots of people who want to travel to and from the UK and can't do so without going into a 10-day quarantine. We have the most highly vaccinated country in Europe, and we have an open border between Northern Ireland and the UK, and we should lift those restrictions on the common travel area like immediately. There's no reason for it, you know.
Except that you're not a public health expert. You're a man who runs a very successful airline. That's your job. Your job is to look after Ryanair. The government's job is to look after the health of the nation. The
Correct.
R number is still around one. The Indian variant has been spreading rapidly in the UK. There have been 20 cases identified here. So, you know, given that, you know, there's not much difference between what you're saying and the government bar a couple of weeks. So isn't patience and caution the right way to go?
Well, it's the HSE this morning are saying that the link has been broken. It's not what Ryanair is saying, it's what the HSE are saying.
With ICU, which is not the same.
To
clarify on that point, Eddie Wilson, because I saw that tweet from Paul Reid, and it was about the fall in hospital numbers, and it was about the fall in ICU numbers. But nonetheless, We still have case rates running in the 400 to 500 region. We still have an R number about around one. We still have significant numbers of younger people who, and there is a risk of a fourth wave.
If you listen to what Paul Reid actually said, he said the link is broken because of the vaccination levels with mortality rates, hospitalizations, and bad outcomes. That's what the HSE are saying. They are an arm of government. What we should do now is, and all as we've asked for all along through this process, is to say, because of aviation, because of the nature of aviation, you've got to give a signpost to say that when you reach certain levels, that you can actually say we're going to open up. That time has long since passed. And we are not against mandatory hotel quarantine from countries outside the European Union. If there's good reason to do that from public health perspective, then do it. But you can't do it in a common travel area because people will just go to third countries. It does nothing from a public health point of view.
So but we're still only talking about a difference of a number of weeks. Why is it so critical? Just to put the question to you. Why is it so critical to you?
Because the rest of Europe is doing it, and there is no public health reason for sustaining this and not being absolutely clear about it. There are people, pilots, cabin crew, engineers, ground crew, who have been out of work for almost a year now. They need the certainty as well. The rest of Europe has opened up, and there is no reason. Ireland is no different than that. Vaccination levels are going to be up to 80% of the population by the end of June. The HSE says the link is broken. Now is the time for the government to say, here's the signpost, let's get back to normality.
Final question to you then on this. And you say the link is broken. That's not to say that there couldn't be
Paul
a fourth
Reid
wave.
Said that, not me.
Your interpretation of it.
That's what he said.
What I am saying to you is that does not mean, and the medical experts have told us this, that there wouldn't be a fourth wave. But parking that for the moment, the aviation industry argues, because again, the government is talking we'll be part of the European digital passport system by mid-July. They're talking about the common travel area in June. So given that we're only talking about a difference of weeks between what you want and they're talking about, why is it so critical we move as urgently as you say?
The digital passport will not make any difference for about 95% of the population for the European Union because they can move freely on the landmass of Europe. And the Minister for Health hiding behind the idea that we're going to have a European passport that's going to give us a green light sometime in June. What we need to do is we need to look at the facts. We're always told to look at the facts. The facts are HSE say that the link has been broken. Hospitalizations are below 100. We have a common travel area with the UK and we have an open border. We need to regularise that, especially because the UK has got the highest vaccination and the lowest cases in Europe. And we need to open up the exact same as other European countries are doing, or we're going to be left behind as we were last year. That's the reason.
At this point in time, but we saw last summer, you know, we were down to just handfuls of cases. And then came the Spanish variant. We saw, and we're just coming out of what happened at Christmas. It is still, while huge progress is being made on the vaccination programme, there are still a huge number of people who have not yet been vaccinated. What is, from your point, why does Ireland lose out by waiting patiently a few more weeks longer for travel
Ireland
to open up?
But like, we have an open border with the UK at the moment. We have an open border. And we have never done anything with that. We have a mandatory hotel quarantine with two countries in the European Union for no good reason whatsoever that is completely 100% ineffective from a public health point of view because people can get around it. We have the most restrictive policy in Europe and the most probably ineffective one as well. Everybody else is moving on because of high vaccination rates and there is no reason to hold back from that and they should do so immediately.
Eddie Wilson, Chief Executive of Ryanair, thank you for talking to us on Morning Ireland.